the notion of impermanence, the idea of impermanence, really underlies the entire edifice of the Buddhist teachings. It's nothing less than the sort of conceptual pathway, if you will, to how we get from this understanding of impermanence to, you know, spiritual liberation. And what I wanted to emphasize, I mean, in the last few weeks we've been talking about the meanings of the word impermanence, how it's discussed in the sutras, and how it's interpreted in terms of the effect of the understanding of impermanence. But this week, what I want to do is put that together with what in traditional Buddhist Theravadin practice, if you were, for example, if you were a monk or a nun, and you were in Burma or Thailand, definitely in Burma, and you were in training, you know, for spiritual awakening. I mean, you were under the guidance of a spiritual teacher, a meditation master, and you were in a course. Say you were in a monk, a monastery for, you know, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, and you were in training for spiritual liberation, this is the training that you would get. Okay, so this is the real deal. This is actually, and of course, you know, this is a description of the training and the logic upon which that training is based. Okay, the logic upon which that training is based. So if you, so this is a way of understanding when we speak of the path of spiritual liberation in the Buddhist context, this is what we're talking about. Okay, so this is, you know, no less than that. So it's really a way of understanding how the actual process of, if you want to call it the curriculum, you know, if you were a monk under training, this is the curriculum that you would be in and how you would be trained to get to this, what they call the final stage of awakening. It's nothing less than that. And the point about this, which I find so compelling and so powerful and so relevant, is the nature of the logic, you know, that this entire sort of sequence, this journey is built upon, the nature of the logic upon which this journey is built upon, and its connection with the concept of impermanence, number one. I mean, it's all based, you know, as we go through it, you'll begin to see how all of this edifice, if you will, the structure, this conceptual structure of liberation in the Theravada Buddhist context, is built on the cornerstone of the understanding of impermanence. And secondly, how this, the psychology of this spiritual journey, the psychology of the spiritual journey is mirrored in the West in terms of philosophical and ideological developments that have happened in Western Europe, in the modern day Western culture. So the exciting thing to me about this is that not only does it lay out the whole Buddhist path to awakening, but in understanding that Buddhist path to awakening, we can begin to connect at a universal level with the understanding of spiritual awakening as it has been developed and evolved in the West in terms of Western sort of religious philosophy, Western religious teachings and Western philosophy. So this is a very, very powerful teaching. I think not only do we understand how the process of awakening occurs within the Buddhist context, but we see the relationship between that and the process of spiritual awakening in the West. And of course, I'm referring to, you know, the work of people like Paul Tillich or, you know, the more, you know, sort of progressive Western thinkers, Martin Buber, Kierkegaard, Bonhoeffer, you know, the European writers, as well as the existential writers like Albert Camus or, post-Second World War, in terms of the whole evolution of, you know, Christian spiritual thinking and writing, and what the connections are, what the similarities are. So this is really, to me, personally, exciting stuff. So I'd like to share that with you today. Now, just as a teaser, I mean, just to sort of set the stage, this sort of curriculum that we speak of in the Buddhist context is called the 16 Stages of Awakening. The 16 Stages of Awakening. So just the presentation of those 16 stages, you know, can fill a whole book. So I'm going to go through it rather rapidly, not, you know, in very much detail, but more in a way of describing the psychology, you know, the way of thinking, you know, as it evolves through these 16 stages and as it gets to the final stage of spiritual liberation and spiritual awakening. Okay. Now, the basic logic, we had discussed this before, so I'm trying to sort of ground this in our previous sort of talks. The basic logic that informs this understanding of impermanence is this idea of knowing that whatever arises passes away. Right? Whatever arises passes away. Everything passes away. Everything is in a process of change. All life arises and passes away. You know, human beings, plants, animals, rocks, everything. There's nothing that does not arise and pass away. So, of course, the obverse of that is that there is nothing that is permanent. There's nothing that is immortal. There's nothing that is immutable. There's nothing that does not change. The law of nature is the law of change. Right? I mean, so at a conceptual level, I don't think that's difficult to understand, right? I mean, it's, nothing is the same. Nothing stays the same. It always changes. But if we truly understand that change is the nature of things, then it allows us to become, the word is, disenchanted. Right? We're not held in the world of enchantment, you know, like we think we're going to be young and beautiful forever, and I'm going to be intelligent forever, and I'm going to be vital forever, or that, you know, the things that I love, the things that I want, you know, are going to last forever, you know. We don't cling to things as if they're going to last forever. That's the enchantment, right, of immortality. That's the enchantment of, you know, a life lasting forever. We become disenchanted. You know, we learn to let go of our dreams for a perfect marriage, a perfect wife, a perfect husband, you know, beautiful children, the white house on the hill, you know, after we've been through about two or three divorces and, you know, two or three mortgages that failed, or a business that went out of business, and, you know, been up and down in life a couple of times, right? We kind of wise up, right? And we call that wisdom, right? We call that wisdom because we know that things are not going to be perfect, right? Things are not perfect. Things are very imperfect. So out of that growth comes a certain, you know, we call it maturity, right? We start to understanding life, right? It's like, so, you know, as we get into 40s or 50s or 60s, you know, we look at life a little differently from when we were in our 20s or our teens, or, you know, where we have stars in our eyes and we're enchanted with all these beautiful, you know, dreams that, you know, that we believe in, and we're enchanted by them, right? So we become disenchanted. We become more realistic, a little wiser. And out of that disenchantment comes a kind of dispassion. The word is dispassion, right? It's a little more equanimous, right? We're not so attached to certain ideas or certain dreams or certain, you know, obsessions that we have. You know, we're less obsessive, compulsive, and holding on to things and clinging to things or pushing things away. You know, we're a little bit wiser. We're a little bit more spacious. We're a little bit more generous. You know, a little bit not as hard-nosed and, you know, sort of judgmental about things. We can, you know, and we normally call this wisdom, right? It's the wisdom of age. It's the wisdom of seeing life. And we start to see that we don't have to cling so deeply onto things. We can start to let go. And we can start to be a little bit wiser, a little bit more spacious. So it's that basic logic, you know, through that, then through dispassion, you know, the sort of stepping away, the kind of letting go of our attachments, our greed, our, you know, our clinging and our aversion to things, our judgments, you know, out of that comes a kind of inner freedom. You know, so we're not as prone to afflictive emotions such as anger or rage or, you know, sadness or grief. So that spaciousness leads to a certain kind of equanimity, a certain peace about ourselves, about life. So that is the sort of the softening, right? The softening of the spirit that comes with wisdom. And out of that softening of the spirit comes a greater opportunity for compassion, you know, for ourselves, because we see how we suffer, we see how we cling to things, we see how we get caught up in our obsessions and our, you know, obsessive compulsive behaviors, our attachments. So that, you know, we can see our suffering. And we see that that seeing of the suffering allows us to be a little, to kind of sort of let go a little bit, you know, and be a little bit more spacious, a little bit more forgiving, a little bit more accepting, ultimately a little bit more compassionate, and with a little bit more loving kindness. So the capacity for compassion, understanding, and loving kindness grows as we develop this sense of equanimity about our lives. Okay, so that's the kind of, that's the basic logic of how this process works. So mindfulness and meditation, right, is really the vehicle that we use to, you know, to come to terms, to see our afflictive emotions, to see our anger, our grief, our sadness, and to see where we get hooked, where we get stuck in things, and begin to work them through so we can begin to let them go, we can begin to understand them better, and as we understand them better, you know, they don't have the control over us that they used to have when we were not aware of the fact that we were caught up in anger or caught up in obsessive compulsiveness or, you know, clinging or aversion. So it's this sense of peace that we get when we start to understand, you know, our afflictive emotions. We start to let them go. And this is the logic of how liberation from suffering starts to occur. And this is the role of meditation, you know, in that process. Now, what I want to do is, given, you know, having said that, so that sets out the model, as it were, this is the logic of how this process works, I'd like to now sort of turn to the so-called 16 stages. Okay, so what these 16 stages are, and I'm just going to sort of run through them, and then in the process of running through them, sort of describe what they're supposed to, what they're supposed to portray, or what they're supposed to say. Let me just, I'm gonna run through the titles real fast. Okay, so it's like you get a scope of it from beginning to end without, you know, sort of getting into a technical discussion of each one. You can get lost in each one. So I'm gonna run through just the titles. Okay, so when you hear the titles, I think you'll see a flow of logic, right, that begins to spell out the big picture. Okay, the first is knowledge of mind and body. These are called vipassana or insight, stages of insight awareness. So these are stages of awareness that you achieve as you go deeper and deeper through the meditative process. So these are called stages of insight. So the first is called knowledge of mind and body. So, nama rupa, mind and body, and I'll explain that in a minute. Knowledge of cause and effect. You might call that knowledge of karma. Knowledge of the three characteristics, which is, you know, suffering, impermanence, and non-self. We'll talk about that. Knowledge of rise and fall. You know, rise and fall is the arising and passing away of phenomena, rising and falling. So, this is getting into the knowledge of impermanence. So you can see how impermanence, the concept of impermanence, is, you know, sort of built in to this whole process of awakening. Then the fifth is knowledge of passing away. So there's this awareness of rising and falling, and then it moves into this knowledge of passing away. And then there's a knowledge of fear. Then there's a knowledge of disgust or misery. Then there's a knowledge of weariness or disenchantment. And there's a knowledge for desire for deliverance. And there's a knowledge of reconciliation, a knowledge of equanimity. And then after that, boom, the opening into liberation. Okay, so there you are. So you saw the flow of logic, right? The flow of logic. So it's like it goes into, it starts off with this awareness of rising and passing away. And then as it moves to the next stage, it comes into this awareness of the passing away, the disappearance of phenomena. Everything is passing away. Now that leads to a sense of fear, a sense of despair, because there's nothing there, right? There's no reality to hold on to. The life that we think we have is but an illusion. We start to realize that. So, it leads to a kind of fear, kind of panic, right? So you start to sense that, what is there to hang on to? And then it goes into, and after it's like this desire for deliverance. It's like, what kind of life am I living? It's a sham. It's a delusion. It's an illusion. I want to be delivered. I want to be freed from this life. And then you go through this whole process of reconciliation, sort of seeing your mind states as they arise, through this process of fear, anguish, despair, and desire for deliverance. And then you arrive at a point of equanimity, which then is the sort of point of resolution, when you start to see the arising and passing away, and you come to a sense of resolution and equanimity about the entire process. So you've come to understand and accept the arising and passing away of phenomena, at the heart level. That's when you're ready for awakening. That's when you've come to the point when you're ready to awaken. So it's this understanding of impermanence that's really the foundation of the entire process. And that's why. So let me go back and I'll go into a little bit more detail. I don't want to get bogged down in this because there's a lot of information here. But I'm going to run through it in as expeditious a way as I can to give you a sense of how this all plays out. Now the first level of insight knowledge is called knowledge of mind and body, nama-rupa. Now there's some people here who understand this because they've attained this in their meditative process. But it's that awareness that comes when you start to see, and of course I'm talking about deep meditative practice, so these are people who come to these levels of awareness are people who have been in long meditating for a long time, years, months, if not years, where they've reached very, very deep levels of concentration and insight. So the very first thing that you start to, as far as this process of deepening awareness is this awakening or this realization that everything we do involves moments of bodily action and mental intention. So for example, if I, lift a stick, right? If I lift a stick, prior to the action of lifting the stick, there was an intention in my mind, right, that said, lift the stick. There was an action in which I lifted the stick. And then there was a moment of cognition in which the stick is lifted, right? So there are three mind-body moments, nama-rupa moments. So in essence, in very simplified language, our entire existence in time and space is but a series of mind and body moments unfolding, in nanoseconds in time and space, all the time. Boom, 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 boom. It's thoughts, actions, thoughts, actions, thoughts, actions, thoughts, actions. And the quality of the thought that we have, you know, whether it's a pleasant thought, an unpleasant thought, or an angry thought, or a sad thought, you know, leading to certain kinds of actions, is determined by our karma. So, you know, what happens, you know, say two people will look at a piece of cheese, and the European person would say, oh, wonderful, piece of cheese, Roquefort cheese, you know, nice, smelly, you know, old, rotten Roquefort cheese, right? Then the Chinese person would say, what do you want this rotten, you know, rotten cow's milk, right? You see what I'm saying? That's karma, right? We look at the same thing, but we interpret it completely differently, depending on how we have been conditioned, right? So our conditioning determines how we sort of see things. But everything unfolds, you know, as moments of intentions, actions, and cognition, intentions, action, cognition, intentions, action, cognition. And it's all in nanoseconds. So it happens so fast, we're not, you know, we're not aware of it, but that's what we're doing. And the clinker in all of this is that that's all we're doing. There doesn't have to be actually a person behind it. It's a process unfolding in time and space. Thoughts and actions, thoughts and actions. We think it's our thoughts, and I think it's my thoughts, my action, because I'm doing it, this body is doing it, and it's associated with this person, right? But in fact, it's simply a process of thoughts and actions, you know, playing out in time and space. So, in essence, we're kind of like, excuse the word, sort of automatons. I mean, we're just mind and body phenomena, you know, unfolding in time and space. Of course, there's a consciousness, there's an awareness, there's a, you know, there's a sense of cognition about this whole process. But the error or the illusion is thinking that there's a person there. There's this immutable sense of self that's doing all this. It's actually a process in and of itself. Okay, so this is the first understanding. And I know some people have talked about, as they get into, like for instance, when you do walking meditation, one of the things we talk about is, you know, lifting, moving, and placing of the foot. You know, the more refined thing is seeing the intention to lift the foot, and the lifting of the foot, and then the knowing that the foot is lifted, and the intention to move the foot, and the moving of the foot, and the knowing that the foot is moved. And then the attention to place, the placing, and then the knowing that the foot is placing. So, just by describing it, I think what I'm trying to convey is, you know, the sense of how time and space become elongated, and your perception becomes so acute, right, that you can see, you know, you can actually sense your mind intending, and then the actual action and the act of cognition when you know. That's the degree of, what shall I say, specificity that the mind is capable of seeing when you get into deeper levels of meditation. Okay, so this gives you an example, you know, of the level of perception, you know, that is cultivated through deep meditation. You know, we've talked about samadhi and concentration. This is what it is. Then the next part, the next level is this awareness, knowledge of conditionality. So conditionality is really this knowledge of karma, how one thing leads to another. You know, a thought leads to an action leads to a cognition that leads to another intention, which leads to another action, and then life plays out as these whole sequences of cause and effect, all the time, cause and effect. It's this process unfolding in time and space. So our lives are these processes unfolding in time and space. We have karmic effects on everything around us. The people we know, our husbands, our wives, our brothers and sisters. And there's this multitudinous web of karmic effects that goes out in the world. So they say, you know, the teaching is karma is complex and almost not understandable because of its level of complexity. But this is how it plays. You know, we play out in these waves of karmic interactions through which we live our lives. So this is starting to see ourselves, you know, in this way as these karmic agents. The third is knowledge of samasana jnana. It's called knowledge of mastery. Another term is knowledge of the three characteristics. Now this is when we start to see how phenomena rise and fall, how they rise and pass away. So we start to see impermanence. So as the meditation deepens, and we'll talk about this later because this is how this is revealed in the meditation, you start to see that thoughts are impermanent because you start to look at thoughts. It's not just the thought arising anymore, but it's how the thought arises. Do you see the thought from the beginning to the middle to the end? So, you know, think of it. When you have a thought, you don't normally think of a thought from the beginning to the middle to the end, right? When the thought comes into your mind, it's already there, right? The thought is already in your mind. You haven't seen the beginning. And most of the time, you don't pay attention to the end because you're onto another thought already. So we never pay attention to the beginning, the middle, and the end of a thought. But if you did, you would see that they just arise and pass away in nanoseconds. And we go from thought to thought to thought to thought to thought to thought to thought. And this is how the mind works. In nanoseconds, we're going from thought to thought to thought to thought to thought. That's how the mind works. And this is the Buddhist psychology in the Abhidhamma. But we don't see each thought as a particular finite phenomena, which is what it is. So at this level of meditation, we're starting to see thoughts that arise. They're there for an instant, and they pass away. Sometimes they might be there for a second, or sometimes a nanosecond, or sometimes a minute, but then they go away. And then something else comes up, and then it's there for a while, and it goes away. So we start to see the mind with that degree of clarity and that degree of detail in terms of how the mind actually works. So one good description is the stage of knowledge is called the knowledge of mastery because the meditator acquires mastery in his understanding of impermanence. For the first time, he can see this complete process of arising, manifesting, and cessation of experience. And seeing the complete process of impermanence, he also has more insight into unsatisfactoriness and non-self. In other words, non-self, if thoughts just are completely arising and passing away, there's no permanent entity to which all of that is, ascribed. It's just this process of thoughts arising and passing away. That is what is describing, this psychophysical phenomena that is my brain, that is my consciousness, that is my awareness. But there's no solid self there. You see what I'm saying? It's a process. And this is a fact that is now being corroborated by modern neuroscience. Modern cognitive neuroscientists are beginning to understand how the brain works and how cognition occurs and how thoughts arise and pass away. And it's all based on, visual, audio, or sensory stimuli that trigger memories that are encoded in the brain. And those memories, are triggered and they pop up. And so we associate certain stimuli with certain memories, which go back through, our lifetime to our childhood sometimes. And through that triggering process, that's how we relate to the stimuli that we receive through the sense doors. Now, because they're triggered through these memory images of our memory, in our memory, it seems like it's happening to me, right? Because there's a sense of self that's implied by the memories that we have about ourselves. But this is just information that comes up in the brain about what happened when we were 5 years old or when we were 12 years old, something happened, boom, and it gets triggered. And of course we think, oh, that was me when I was 12 years old. So we think there's a self there. But all it is this information that's coming up, and it seems to imply a sense of continuity of a being there, but in fact it's just pure information that arises and arises in a certain way that seems to imply a sense of a being there, but in fact, it's an illusion. It's just a process of information that's constantly been triggered by the brain. So then we come up to this, the next phase is knowledge of arising and passing away. It's called Udiyabhayana. Now for a lot of people, this is really the culmination of the practice. This is where this knowledge of arising and passing away gets to a complete state of kind of fruition, in the sense that it's really confirmed. It's called purification of overcoming doubt of arising and passing away. And purification of knowing and seeing the way in its mature stage. Now, so this is like when you truly understand and embody, you know, the concept of impermanence. So, you know, this is why, you know, I've been emphasizing impermanence so much, because it's such a central concept to this entire process, you know, of spiritual understanding. Now, for many meditators, this is a peak experience. This is when you really get into these heightened hyper stages of rapture and bliss, and this is called in the stages of absorption. This is called the first stage of full blown jhana, the first jhanic state, the state of rapture and bliss. So you might experience a rapture, a tranquility, a sense of bliss, of happiness, a sense of, and this sort of begins to solidify, you know, your sense of faith in the Dharma, the sense of faith in this concept of impermanence. You start to see impermanence, you understand it, and you stand strong in your understanding of impermanence, because it starts to allow you to begin to release the concept of self-identity and clinging and holding on to things. Because if everything is impermanent, it passes away, there's nothing to cling on to, there's nothing to hold on to. So it's basically you're starting to let go of things because you see the impermanence of all things. This is disenchantment. This is disillusionment. This is dispassion. So this is how this whole process, the psychology of letting go, starts to take place during the meditation process. Okay, so we're up to this point of just seeing impermanence in its fullest, most developed form. Now the next part is where it gets really interesting. After you get to this sort of heightened sort of awareness of arising of impermanence, you come to what is called the knowledge of dissolution, or Bhanga Jnana. Now Bhanga Jnana is a stage where your awareness becomes stronger and stronger and stronger, to the point where you start to see phenomena, you know, as they move away from you. Now, of course, we're talking in the meditative state, so in your normal consciousness, you wouldn't see this. So what's happened is, as a result, he sees only the passing away of phenomena. It's as if his awareness is so fast, it is faster than the experience he's actually examining. As soon as he places attention on some aspect of his experience, it disappears. So this is the knowledge of dissolution. So this also can be interpreted as the sense of losing your concentration. It seems like the meditator can no longer focus on anything because his attention keeps sliding off whatever he tries to look at, because it seems to be disappearing all the time. It can be trying to grasp onto something that slips out of your hand all the time. What's happening is you're seeing the disappearance of phenomena, the ending of phenomena. So now the attention is going not from the arising and passing away, but to the passing away of phenomena. Okay. Now another thing that meditators report at this point, and I'm saying this kind of parenthetically, but this is something that's really, I think, key to those who are more advanced meditators, because some people have experienced similar experiences. Another thing that meditators report at this stage is the disappearance of the form of the body. The disappearance of the form of the body. Before, the meditator saw the experience break up into specific and discrete experiences, like sensations, you know, in the body, thoughts, feelings, emotions. But he always knew that there were experiences of something. For example, the experience of the rising movement of the abdomen when breathing breaks up into movements, pressure, tension. But there was always a sense, when observing the rising and falling of the abdomen, that they belong together as different aspects of the same thing. But now movement is just movement. Pressure is just pressure. Tension is just tension. There's no sense of what part of the body these sensations belong to. So you move into this whole perception of sensations, you know, almost disembodied from a sense of its connection to a physical body. The sense of the body disappears. All that is left is a series of apparently disconnected individual sensations. The body simply disappears. The next is called knowledge of fear. That's level 6, called bhaya-nirana. Now this is where it gets interesting. In the disappearance of everything examined, so things are disappearing, right? You're seeing the disappearance of phenomena. The mind at some level begins to realize there is nothing beneath the parade of changes. It's just phenomena disappearing. There's no foundation. At a fundamental level, there's nothing at all. The result is existential anxiety. In its strong form, this can be manifest as panic. And you can actually, you know, feel panic because it's as if reality was disappearing in front of your eyes. In its weak form, it can be merely a sense of existential unease or anxiety, a sense of nothing going right, a sense of helplessness, a sense of loss of control. At this stage of the practice, the meditator's insight into not-self usually takes this form of a sense of loss of control. You have no control over what's happening in your body. I am not in control of my life. And this is true, this happens, because you get to the point where even your breathing, you know, things are coming into your mind, sensations are coming and going, your body is seemingly marching to some different drummer who you have no idea who it is. And even sounds, sensations, they seem to be disconnected. And, you know, your emotions, your perceptions are at such a fine hairline trigger because your awareness is so acutely sensitive that anything could trigger you one way or the other at any moment. See, the point here is that, you know, you're at a stage where your perceptions, your sensitivity is really hyper. You're at a hyper level of sensitivity. So emotionally, cognitively, sensually, in terms of your sensitivity to sensual, you know, input sight, smells, you know, touch, everything is hyper sensitive. And so it seems as though you're just being bombarded. You know, they say that schizophrenia is a form of hypersensitivity to sensual phenomena. You have no way of controlling, right, what information comes into your awareness. And it's almost as if that's happening. So because you're becoming so hyper-aware, you know, of the world around you, that you seem to lose control of what's happening in your mind. So in that sense, anatta, or the sense of self, there's no sense of self in the sense of your ability to control what's going on. It's out of control. So this leads to the sense of anxiety, the sense of panic, the sense of fear, you know, that you start to feel at this stage. Then it goes to 7, which is knowledge of danger, adinava jnana. It's also called knowledge of disgust or misery. Now what that is, one of the ways it's described is, you're at the stage where it's looking dangerous. It's already, you know, you're at the stage where things are kind of disappearing, you know, your hold on reality is evaporating. Your sense of self seems to be dissolving, and you know there's almost a sense of danger now. It's like your existence is somehow imperiled. The meditator realizes that there is no rest, no security in anything. Notice that the emphasis here is on anything. There's no reassurance. The meditator by this time is fantasizing about escape from the meditation center. He's wondering why he's not in some comfortable job making a comfortable, secure living. But the power of insight knowledge is such that he knows there is no escape. He knows that this danger, this disadvantage remains, because he knows that this is the nature of experience as such. So he's holding on, right? He's holding on to this slim, you know, cliff, you know, of reality, of what he wants reality to be, but he sees that just simply crumbling to nothing. And he's falling into the abyss of nothingness. He's falling into the abyss of nothingness. So, you know, this could be pretty disturbing, you know, if you're at that level where you start to see your entire life just falling away. What you think is your life falling away. See, this is the point. What you think is your life falling away. And the next is knowledge of disenchantment. Remember that phrase, disenchantment. So this is where disenchantment comes in. It's also called knowledge of desire for deliverance. It's like help. You're at this stage now. And you know, everything is falling away. There's nothing left. Your sense of self is dissolving. So what this is, it's, you know, the phrase that this writer uses is the get me out of here stage. Of course, this knowledge includes the understanding that whatever situation the meditator escapes to, that too will be unsatisfactory. And the urge to escape will be seen there in that new situation. Symptoms of this stage of the practice can include a great deal of physical pain, restlessness, agitation. The meditator may be unable to hold any posture of the body for any period of time. Any posture can be painful. Sometimes meditators retreat to bed or sleep for long periods of time just to escape the pain involved in that level of consciousness, because it is so painful, it's existentially painful, you know, to face this sense of dissolution of self and, you know, the sense that you're losing, you know, your conventional self of who you are. And then it goes to the next stage, which is called knowledge of reconciliation. This is stage 10. Now, this is very, very crucial. It's also called knowledge of reconsideration or knowledge of despair. So, you know, this is the point of despair. It's like everything I know, I believe, I am, is gone. I'm in a state of despair. I'm in a state of complete existential angst. Now, this is what the word angst means, right? Where everything you believe that's solid, firm, stable, reliable is gone. And there's just nothing. If all is left is angst, anxiety, existential angst. So this is called despair. This is the stage of despair. Now, this is characterized by two things. Firstly, the meditator may be assailed by all kinds of suffering he has gone through before, as well as some new experiences. He may feel as if he has lost all insight he may have even had before. He may feel he has lost the ability to concentrate. He may even go through these periods when he forgets how to do the practice itself. Now, this stage is number 10, is the crucial transitional stage. And that's why it has two names. One is the stage of despair, and one is the stage of reconsideration. Now, they mean two different things. What reconsideration means is that if you don't bug out, right, if you don't give up, if you don't leave the center and you sit through this stage of despair and, you know, sort of angst, you start to begin to see that this is nothing but a mind state. You start to see that you're actually caught up in an extreme form of aversion, right? It's an aversion because you're losing what you're holding on to. You're losing what's familiar, what's stable. So you're in an extreme state of despair, you know, which is not that different from rage or anger or sadness or grief. So this is where the mindfulness starts to kick in, And you start to see that that feeling itself is nothing but a mind state. It's a mind state that itself arises and passes away. The reconsideration is the fact when you realize that the entire journey that you've been on, as far as the journey of existential angst, has come to this point of despair, which itself is a mind state. It's the obverse form of greed. In other words, aversion. It's an aversive mind state. And if you're able to sit through that mind state and allow it to dissolve, then you arise to the next level, which is called knowledge of equanimity regarding formations, or sankharupaka. You rise to this high level of equanimity because you have literally gone through the entire existential journey of impermanence, and you come to this point of equanimous, you know, balance, because you've been able to deal with that despair that, you know, has come up for you. At this point, a subtle but fundamental shift takes place, and the meditator enters a stage of the practice called knowledge of equanimity regarding formations. This is the reward for all the work he has done and the suffering he has endured up to this point. Now the dominant factor in the meditator's mind are awareness and equanimity. There's a sense of peace. It's almost this sublime sense of peace. All forms of pain either disappear or are minimized. There is little or no sense of mental disturbance. The meditation carries on by itself. It seems to sort of flow by itself, with little or no conscious effort on the meditator's part. He finds he can sit and walk for long periods of time and needs little sleep. The attention rests naturally on a few experiences, staying on the same experience for long periods of time. In other words, his concentration is pure, strong, solid, and long-lasting. You don't need so much sleep. You know, you're in that. You're literally in the zone in the most kind of ultimate sense. At this point, the meditator feels he understands the practice as if for the first time. It is so simple and so obvious. This attitude of clarity and simplicity carries over into everything else. Life itself is so simple and so obvious. How could he ever have gotten himself tangled up in such big problems? Everything is fundamentally okay. A meditator at this stage of the practice is very difficult to be upset. This is the stage of equanimity. Now, this is in the practice to get to the stage of sankharupaka or equanimity is really sort of the sort of takeoff point. This is the point where you're ready, you know, for breakthrough. Okay, so when you're in this state of equanimity, you can be there for any period of time, for hours, for days, for weeks, depending on, you know, how long you're meditating. You just stay at this stage. And once you've sort of, in a sense, you know, you can understand what I mean, you've been through what there is to be through, and you've come to this point of resolution and reconciliation and equanimity. So you're ready to step off the edge. So the stepping off the edge is called magapala, or path in fruition consciousness. And that's that stage, actually it goes from stage 12, 13, 14, and 15, so it's like they happen sort of instantaneously. And it's basically called path in fruition consciousness. And what happens at that moment, and I'm reading a verbal description, the next two stages are knowledge of adaptation, which is prior to path in fruition, and the knowledge of connection. They may just be theoretical constructs to explain the sudden manifestation of the next stage, which is path in fruition consciousness. In practice, what happens is that the meditator is practicing that every aspect of his meditation is subtle, clear, and bright. And then suddenly, there's a sense of falling into something, and the lights go out. The lights go out. There's a momentary sense of nothingness. And then the lights come back on. If the meditator checks the watch, he sometimes realizes that some time has passed since his consciousness went out and his consciousness came back, depending on the strength of his concentration. So this could be anything from a few minutes to sometimes a few hours, and in some cases a few days. What he's experienced is called cessation. Essentially, the consciousness stops for a period of time. In the beginning, it's very short. It could only be a couple of seconds. But as the practice is cultivated, that sense, that period of cessation can get longer and longer, to the point where it said it could be in a number of days. Certainly hours, it can be in cessation for a matter of hours. So this is a kind of moment when you realize that you've reached the ultimate sort of level of consciousness, where you've seen impermanence of the consciousness itself. Consciousness itself is not impermanent. I mean, it's not permanent, it's impermanent. So there's a last sort of stage, which is called knowledge of review, or paccavekana jnana. So that's the moment when you realize what happened, when you come back to consciousness. So what has happened? Has he fallen asleep? No, because the suddenness and clarity of the beginning and the end of the experience of unconsciousness, and because there's been absolutely no physical movement. You're sitting there, your eyes are closed. Boom, you're unconscious, and then boom, you're conscious again. With that kind of suddenness, it happens. What the meditator has experienced is the total cessation of the mind-body process. He did not know this while this was happening. Obviously, he couldn't know it while it was happening, because there was no sense of a mind to know it. All he knows about the experience is his reflection on what has just happened. This reflection is the final insight knowledge, the knowledge of review of awakening. So this journey of insight from normal experience to increasing subtlety of experience to the most subtle experience of all results in the cessation of experience itself. So this experience of cessation, once it's, of course, it's you generally report it to your teacher, and if it's confirmed that you've actually experienced this, will be an indication that you've achieved the first stage of awakening, which is called stream entry, in the Buddhist teachings. And there are four levels of awakening: stream entry, once returning, non-returning, arahant. And this is the process that you go through. So what I've described is really the dynamics of the first 16 stages that you get to get to stream entry. Now, what I want to sort of, having said this, I want to bring it back, because as I was reading this, and as I was practicing this, what really struck me was this whole sequence of, fear, misery, disenchantment, desire for deliverance, this sense of betrayal of reality. It struck me how similar it was to the existentialist literature, of the post-Second World War. And if you think about what happened in the Second World War, literally, if you were a God-fearing Christian, a Catholic or a Protestant Christian in Europe, you had serious grounds to question the existence of God after experiencing what had happened, in Germany or France or Belgium or Italy. And so it was after that Second World War, Nietzsche, God is dead, the existentialist philosophers, Camus, Sartre, you know, the liberal Christian thinkers, Bonhoeffer, Kierkegaard, fear and trembling unto death, and ultimately Paul Tillich. And, you know, the writers like Merton after that, who completely redefined, you know, basically they went through exactly the same process that this process is all about. It's called disillusionment, disenchantment, and dispassion. They went through that same process. No longer was God this, you know, this anthropomorphic old man sitting on a throne with a white beard and a trident and dictating reality. That just didn't hold anymore. How could that God allow what happened in Europe in the Second World War? 11 million, I don't know, 200 million deaths. You know, the complete, you know, destruction of whole civilizations, you know, whole empires. Almost the complete eradication of the Jewish population. How could a humane God, you know, allow that sort of thing to happen? And there was a complete rethinking, disillusionment of this traditional form of Christianity. And I don't think it's an accident. You know, I don't think it's an accident that this happened in Europe. You know, which suffered through, you know, the full consequences, you know, of the Second World War. And what's happening in the United States? I mean, of course, the United States, you know, was a full participant in the Second World War, but they didn't go through what the Europeans did. I mean, we were insulated, you know, from the effects of what the Europeans, you know, experienced. So we never had to go through that kind of existential rethinking of our whole relationship to God, you know, that the Europeans did. And that's why, you know, Christianity in Europe, in many ways, is very different from the way it is in the United States. So it's this disillusionment, disenchantment, by seeing impermanence. You know, things are not what they seem to be, right? We have this faith in this permanent, immortal, continual, eternal, all of these, you know, great sort of words for concepts that give us a sense of succor, you know, S-U-C-C-O-R, give us a sense of relief from, you know, the exigencies and the difficulties of our human lives. But there is nothing. It's just the reality of our human lives. That is the reality. And the only sad thing about the existentialists and the Paul Tillich and the later Christian philosophers were able to resolve this to a certain extent, but the existentialist philosophers didn't know about knowledge of reconciliation and sankharipaka, equanimity. In other words, they didn't have the capacity, right? Because what the existentialists were talking about was disgust, right? Angst, anxiety, despair and rejection, you know, absurdity. You know, if you've read, you know, Sartre or Camus, you know, they talk about the absurdity of modern contemporary life, the absurdity of Christian idolatry, the absurdity of, you know, materialism, capitalism and industrialism and commodification of human beings and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But they were led into a kind of rejection, you know, civilization. So they became this outcast, almost a kind of, you know, sort of a rejectionist movement. Rather than, in the Buddhist context, they were able to reconcile it, to see it as a mind state that was a basis for suffering. So the existentialists never were really able to come out of their suffering, you know, to a path of reconciliation and equanimity. But in Buddhism, this was done 3,000 years ago. They already, you know, spell out a path to reconciliation, equanimity, and peace through the entire process of seeing the impermanence of all things. The impermanence of all things. So this is the logic of liberation, you know, as embodied, you know, within the Buddhist path to liberation. And you can see it's a very human thing, right? It's like, I call it this picaresque novel, you know, of the sojourner through the journey of life, right? Learning, it's like, what was that, Candide, you know, sort of the opposite of Candide, you know, where everything is for the good, you know. But this is the sojourner through life who begins to see despair and suffering and begins to see the impermanence that underlies all of these things, and through that understanding attains awakening. And that was the journey of the Buddha. That was the journey of the Buddha. He saw this, and he saw the implications of it as it played out through all of reality. So thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to present this.
As we were talking about all of this, all that came into my mind was that immigrant that lost his children
exactly.
And wife, and who says, I have nothing, everything that was precious to me is
gone. Yeah.
So he's at the point where...
despair.
Yeah.
So that's exactly this despair. So this is what, you know, the Dharma teaches us. You know, we start to see that it comes to nothing. You know, all of the conventional things that we hold on to come to nothing. So where do we go from there? How do we find peace? How do we find meaning? Even our own death, right? Our own impermanence. How do we find peace? How do we find a way of living through all of this impermanence with a sense of equanimity and peace? That's what this whole practice is all about. To me, that's the quintessential message of the Dharma. It's how do we move through all of the difficulties of our life, all the impermanence, the fact that there's in fact nothing there. I mean, in the real world, of course, there are people and, you know, situations and, you know, life to be lived, but fundamentally, it's all an illusion, right? It's all arising and passing away, arising and passing away. People arise and passing away. You arise and pass away. Thoughts, feelings, emotions, sensations, objects, everything is arising and passing away. So it's this continual sort of movie of things arising and passing away. There's nothing to hold on to. So how do you come to terms with that? How do you come to peace with that? And including you. You know, you arise and pass away. Your death, right? So that's the central question in all of Buddhism. So if you can come to that sense of peace and equanimity, that is what liberation is. That's what freedom is. That's the definition of freedom. And it's based on this understanding of impermanence. It just comes down to that. So there's nothing left to hold on to. And you can be okay with that. You can be okay with that. If you're okay with that, nothing can bother you because you're not attached to anything. You're completely free. You see that all things arise and pass away. So you can be equanimous about all things. That's the whole point of the practice.